The Odds of Three, written by G Squared and read by Believe to Be Free. The first time June walks into Aiba's cafe, he's convinced that the coffee will be overpriced and substandard. Nevertheless, it is noon and there isn't a single free space at Starbucks, save one at the bar-style table opposite a couple of high school students having a moment. In a slight panic to finish a major site overhaul that an alarm clock company requests at last minute, ha bloody ha, he walks three streets and gratefully ducks into the first place that has coffee, without noticing that the shop's name is Happy Bean, with an exclamation mark no less. The place is virtually deserted, save another customer hunched over his laptop typing furiously, cup sitting forgotten. June hurriedly orders an espresso from the man at the counter, who gives him an unusually wide smile, which just makes him more suspicious. It must be to compensate for the lousy coffee. He takes the cup and sits at one of the long narrow tables stretching along the sides of the cafe, powering up his Mac and plugging it into the switch at the same time, all with the air of practiced efficiency. Then he takes a sip of the coffee and is hooked. By the time he's finished with his work, it is 8. He looks up and is surprised to find himself surrounded by people. There's the temptation to order another one of those orgasmic brews, but a gaggle of girls has surrounded the counter and he decides that tonight he should really just catch some sleep. It is inching towards midnight when Yoon shuts his laptop, pulling out a charger on his Mac. 3 seats away, he is still bent over his keyboard, concentration lines etched into his face, illuminated by the backlight of his computer screen. Yoon stands and stretches backward, back popping satisfyingly. He leans over Sho's shoulder, chin just barely touching the wool of his jumper. Sho's hair brushes against his cheek when he turns.
Yeah?
You sound asleep, June tells him. Just making sure you aren't playing online poker or whatever.
I was never into poker, Sho says.
All gamblers are the same. Sho does exactly what June wants him to. He swivels on his seat, facing June with a slight frown on his face.
Since when?
Kidding, June says, smiling.
But not about the sleep bit. Come on, leave it. The government isn't going to collapse tomorrow without your dissertation.
You don't know that, is Sho's only protest. But he obediently allows himself to be led off the seat to a cushy chair. Sho and June have a rule that they aren't allowed to sit in those before 11:30 p.m. because they seriously compromise productivity. Sure enough, Sho sinks into the upholstery with an audible sigh.
Ah, finally!
Aiba walks out, holding a dishcloth.
I'm making a fresh pot, he tells June, who grins.
Who's the addict now? Shaw says, eyes half closed.
Kevin doesn't count,
June tells Shaw. Iba sits on a poof, long legs folding around him.
How's it going?
He asks June.
Finally done with the Yasuda account,
June says, yawning. They signed them spiffy little rollover links. Gotta count as a significant career move.
There's an ambitious one,
Shaw remarks.
Sorry if I can't measure up to your Nobel Peace Prize,
June retorts. Whatever, I like my job. I just...
Iba is looking at him intently, waiting for him to finish his sentence.
I just see myself somewhere else.
He stares at the murky light of the lamppost outside Iba's shop and admits to himself that he always has.
I'm going to check on the coffee.
Iba rises abruptly, heading behind the counter for the warm kitchen.
Okay,
June says. But when he turns back, Shaw is looking at him, oddly awake.
The second time, it is closer to 10 and Starbucks is only half full, but he walks right past. It is a different man who takes his order this time, though he looks vaguely familiar and seems bothered by the fact that someone is ordering espresso at this time of night. He settles into the same seat, opening his laptop and putting on headphones, vaguely registering the large group of people trickling out onto the street, talking and laughing. The coffee is just as brilliant as before, and he takes a moment for his brain to become a caffeine-induced puddle while waiting for his computer to start up. This time, he occupies himself with the backlog of his clients' requests for minor changes, and then gets to typing out their invoices. A relaxed, almost morose mood falls over him, and when he saves his last document, he realizes with a start that it is 11:45. The cafe is dim, although there are still sounds from the kitchen, the slow hum of the oven and the coffee maker. June packs up quickly, embarrassed that he is keeping them open. Just as he is leaving, someone emerges from behind the counter, and there is that smile again. June mutters a sheepish apology and ducks out into the cool night, barely noticing that there is another laptop left open in that same seat.
Did you mean that? Shaw asks. That? I do like my job, if that's what you're wondering.
Not that. Shaw is watching him contemplatively, wearing a look June has never seen before. Not even when Shaw gets properly into his aging population internal debate mode.
Do you like it here? Are you happy? It's not about that.
June takes a breath, and in those few seconds everything is uncannily quiet.
I've always felt like I could be more, find more, see more, feel more. But I don't. I haven't found anything extraordinary, anything worth talking about. There's nothing.
He makes a vague gesture again.
Special.
Special?
Shaw repeats. What's special? You know, June says, something more than real life.
How do you know you'll ever find something like that?
Shaw says.
There's a tiny smile on the corner of his mouth, but there's something like sadness in his eyes, something like resignation. It is a startlingly alien emotion, and for a moment, June is disconcerted.
A lot of people do.
I think you underestimate real life, Shaw stands, and June suddenly remembers that Iba still isn't back.
Come on, let me show you something.
Shaw leads him out the front doors of the shop. There's a decided chill in the air, and June shivers, while the glass doors of Happy Bean close with a jingle. He folds his arms to keep warm. Shaw is standing at his side, seemingly unaffected by the cold.
Look at that,
Shaw says, pointing at a sign at the edge of the main doors. June bends, wondering what is important enough for them to be out in this frigidity. He's only wearing a t-shirt.
We are open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., it says, coupled with an irrepressibly cheerful smiley face.
Reflexively, June's glance switches to his watch. It glows back at him. 124. The sign has always been there, since the place opened. Incomprehensible. And then, June is stunned. It spreads through him, enveloping him in a curious sensation. Sean nudges him inside, but June hardly feels the welcome of the heated air.
What?
He pauses as Sean gently tucks him down to sit.
Are you saying?
I'm not. I'm not trying to pass judgment. Sean shrugs, and despite how numb he feels, June discerns a distinct lack of accusation. It's just that when you say you haven't found what you're looking for, then it makes the rest of us doubt if we have. June is shaking his head, quite involuntarily, but Shaw puts a hand on his shoulder, squeezing reassuringly.
Is that just you or not?
We're both here, aren't we? Shaw says. He sits back just as the smell of coffee drifts out, preempting Iba's reemergence.
Junkun, yours?
Iba passes him a cup which he takes with both hands. He inhales, and it's not just that thick, bitter warmth. It's familiarity. For the first time, June doesn't really taste the coffee. They sit in unspoken silence, the memory of Sho's hand pressing, weighing him down. The third time June comes to Iba's shop, it is peak hour, filled with the chatter of the office crowds just off work. June takes a different seat this time, one that faces inward. He sits down with toast and a drink, regular coffee this time. The flow of customers thins out as the evening wears on. June watches the cashier with interest. It is that man again, the one who smiles at everyone. The ones June assumes are regulars get a stream of small talk. Every so often, laughter drifts over to June's table. It is a laugh that he recognizes by the third time, and he finds, oddly, that it has managed to endear itself to him. Midway through the hour, a skinny man enters the cafe, trailed by a smaller figure, bundled in a jacket, scarf, and topped off with a brown head of wind-ruffled hair. The brown hair meanders absent-mindedly past the refrigerated pastries, standing at the counter looking at the little packets of cookies with mild interest. The first man heads straight behind the counter. A bit later, June hears an, "Oi, Masaki!" There is an excited bustle, and June eventually figures out that they all know each other. Even the jacket and scarf, which turns out to be hiding a guy with a perpetually inscrutably blank expression. They get ushered to a table and served a daunting assortment of cakes, which somehow disappear within the next 15 minutes. A fourth joins them, and June finally recognizes him. The dude with the laptop, who somehow also manages to be Mr. Concerned about espresso after 10. The remaining dregs of his coffee are cold, and he decides to order another. Instead of the guy called Masaki, the other gets up to take his order. June gives the espresso a break in favor of mocha and not worrying the caffeine-conscious guy too much. It is strange, because for all the intents and purposes, he could have sworn he was just another customer. June assumes that it is a part-time job. After all, Happy Bean didn't appear to have any other staff. He alternates between his laptop, people watching, and innocuous eavesdropping on the little party huddled at the table nearest the counter. By 10, June knows their names. Masaki is Aiba Masaki. He owns the cafe, fusses over them with food, and is indefatigably enthusiastic, even in the face of the skinny one's sarcasm, which, though good-natured, is quite a force to be reckoned with. That one's called Nino, and he mightn't show it outright, but June gets the feeling that beneath all that quick wit, there is real intelligence. The laptop guy slash occasional cashier is Shaw, amusing and often amused by the banter between Aiba and Nino. June gleans from the scant conversation on the topic that he's trying to get into university, something that Nino apparently cannot fathom. The quiet one is Ono, and they each defer to him in their own small ways. June is surprised to find that the toast he ate earlier was Ono's. That guy baked. They are a motley crew that appear to have figured their way around each other. Every time someone comes in, either Ibo or Shaw rise to serve them. As the minutes trickle by, the customers get fewer and further in between. June is somewhat glad for it, because they bring in gusts of cold, frosty air that he could really do without. Once or twice, they get up at the same time. When that happens, Ibo pushes Shaw gently back into his seat with a laugh, saying something that June doesn't catch. Again, he is so absorbed in that quiet, self-contained congregation of activity that he only realizes the time when Ono gets up to stretch. He is compact, hair in all directions, so it wasn't just the wind. The last time, he'd left sheepishly and in a hurry. Now, he is reluctant, but nonetheless, he packs up his things and returns the coffee cup. As he is leaving, he hears Ibo call out, "Good night." He turns and cannot help but return Iba's smile. The rest are looking at him, too. Shaw waves, Nino wearing an expression of bordering a smirk, Ono caught in a yawn. "Thank you," he replies, and braces himself against the approaching winter, joining the few people still out at midnight while he heads for the train station. June's breath mists in the air as he walks towards the cafe. Hands stuffed in his pockets, purposeful. The windows are dark from a block away, and for a moment his feet go right past. But the surge of stifling indecision passes, and he swivels a little on his heels, heading straight through the doors. Shaw is dozing, head drooping toward the high counter he's seated at. He startles awake at the jingle of the opening door, even as June tries to be quiet. "June?" He barely has time to say before June walks up to him and, trying not to be too nervous, presses up against Shaw's back. Cautiously, like he told himself to, he reaches an arm around Shaw's waist. The other runs up his arm until they are perfectly parallel. "June," Shaw says again, except this time it is not a question. He presses a trembling kiss to the only part of Shaw's neck he can reach. It is awkward, strange, excruciating, until Shaw cranes his neck so he can meet the kiss, and suddenly it is an entirely different game. He forgets himself as he slides against Shaw, unwilling to lose contact, until they are at an easier angle and he can see that Shaw is smiling. June's stomach lurches in the split second that his brain tells him that it is pity, a giant misunderstanding, and a "let's forget about it." But it is none of those things, and June hides the shock by curling his arm around Shaw, so tight he can feel Shaw's hip bone through their clothes.
"Wait, June." "For what?"
June says, embarrassingly, tellingly impatient. But this is a moment he wants to cling on to, and everything else can wait.
"We have to talk,"
Shaw says, but his eyes close anyhow when June kisses him, properly this time, and in full control. His mouth even follows every insinuation of motion that June makes, and June is suddenly so fascinated with the involuntary arch of Shaw's back while he's sitting on the high stool that he completely doesn't notice Ibo walking out, completely misses the look on his face.
"There's something I'm not sure if you know," Shaw murmurs, and with no distance between them, June almost swallows the words.
And then Shaw looks up, looks over, and June follows his gaze, meets surprise, want, and hope, all in one expression. June's throat shrinks so much in 1 second he nearly chokes, taking 3 frantic underwater steps away from Shaw.
"You meant... but you didn't say..."
June's tone is hurt and accusation all at once, and Shaw flinches. They all flinch.
"June, what does it matter?"
2 is enough," June says. 1 is alone. 3 is too much. 2 is enough." June walks away like he might never come back.
The first time June talks to Aiba is when Aiba accidentally leaves a box of straws by the counter, obstructing the way. Aiba seems to be taking stock, which June notices out of the corner of his eye. He also notices the impending disaster a second before it happens. The next, coffee grounds are flying and the box is all bent out of shape. Shaw yelps. Aiba goes down with a kind of subdued chaos, sprawling painfully on the floorboards as the coffee grounds do little to cushion his fall. June leaps up, forgetting for a moment that he is still a stranger. The comical mess is splayed across the whole area beside the counter, and June doesn't know where to start. He reaches out a hand. "Whoa," says Aiba, slipping a little again on coffee grounds. June anchors his weight and hefts Aiba up.
"Stop, you can't get wet grounds off,"
he tells Aiba, who meekly obeys. Or perhaps it is because of the colourful language June never imagined Shaw even knew.
"What possessed you to?"
"It's okay," June says, not sure who he intends to calm down. At the same time, Aiba gives a little ow, and they all notice that his hand is still clutching the fragments of a cup handle, the rest of the cup lying on the floor. "Just sit there," June says. "Do you have a first aid kit?"
"I'll get it," Shaw says.
He disappears into the kitchen. "It's really nothing," Aiba starts to say, but June gives him a stern look that tells him not to budge. He pushes the forlorn box of straws out of the way and surveys the mess. Just one tray of broken cups. He's dealt with worse. Shaw appears with the first aid. "Let's clean you up first," he tells Aiba, who returns a watery sort of smile. Within 10 minutes, June has the vicinity cleaned, coffee grounds dumped in the trash. Aiba can't stop thanking him.
"Don't worry about it,"
he tells Aiba, who insists, sitting him down and telling him to wait. "I'll get you coffee free of charge for the rest of the week, really, if you want. Oh, unless this has put you off the coffee around here."
"It's fine," June reassures him, and accepts, if only to stop the speeding train that Aiba's speech resembles.
"It's been over a week," June tells him the second time Aiba waves away his handful of coins.
"Plus, you only said free coffee. How are you going to pay Ono-san if you don't collect the prices you charge?" "How do you know about Ono?"
Hyo says, 3 seats away, and June's cheeks are suddenly hot.
"I might have just happened to hear."
Then he realizes that Hyo is smiling, more amused than anything. June is still mortified, but Shaw is looking pointedly back at the computer screen, as if to let the subject drop. Aiba relents too. "Fine, you can pay for the bread," he tells June. "But coffee after 10 is free."
"And you close at when?"
June says, teasing. "Late," Aiba says, ducking his head to rearrange the toast display, while Shaw hides a laugh behind his laptop. Snow falls in January, a grimy, half-hearted city sort of snow that only half melts on the sidewalks, shoveled away by tired street workers. Darkness falls absurdly early. By 10, Shaw and Aiba are the only ones left in the cafe. Shaw comes up behind Aiba, gently lifts his soapy hands out of the water.
"Leave them to me," he says. "Go outside for a bit. Make some coffee."
At Aiba's hesitation, he adds, "Go on. I'll drink some with you." A smile crinkles the edges of Aiba's eyes.
"But you won't be able to sleep tonight."
"Doesn't matter," Shaw tells him. By the time he's done with the dishes, the thick aroma of coffee beans has wafted into the kitchen. The coffee machine gurgles a little as he steps out. Aiba is standing by the counter, upper body leaning against the wall.
"The place looks bigger when he's not around," Aiba says, musing.
Shaw nods in assent. He wouldn't leave the cafe tonight if he didn't have to.
"He'll miss this too," Shaw says after a moment.
Aiba pours out the coffee, and Shaw keeps quiet, allowing him that fleeting rush of familiarity to temporarily mute that ever-present want.
They sip in silence. The taste bitter on Cho's tongue. He's never been much of a coffee drinker, but when he does drink them, he doesn't add milk or sugar. It's odd, yet fitting, that something so heady, intense, and dark always reminds him of Aiba. And now, someone else. What was it like? Aiba is hunched over in one of those fluffy chairs, sinking so deep in that his knees are in line with his chest. How did he feel? The cup is clutched between his hands. Sho sets down his own nearly empty cup, realizes he's been waiting for Aiba to ask. And he would never deny him knowledge like that. So carefully, he uncurls Aiba's fingers from around the cup, leads the willing form to the high stool. An arm goes around Aiba's midriff, fingers tightening ever so slightly on the damp t-shirt as he remembers the rush from June's unspoken yet soldiering insecurity inches from him. And as he slides an arm down the smooth, cool skin of Aiba's bare arm, it gives him another rush altogether. He tells himself to concentrate on both things at once. For the two of them, he cannot lose himself in memory. He has to keep it safe, share the sacredness of experience, even while forging an entirely new path of discovery. Like this, Aiba murmurs, and Sho's mouth sloppily against Aiba's neck. Almost exactly. Hardly daring to breathe, they grope around each other. Sho's hand goes to Aiba's waist, thumb planted firmly above his waistband, as he kisses Aiba, open-mouthed. "You were there too," he tells Aiba, just as the kiss ends, both their faces flushed. "He smelled like you, and he felt like you, except he was him at the same time. And it was the best thing I'd ever felt, the two of you."
"What are you always doing on your laptop?"
Aiba peers at Jun's screen, dishcloth accidentally making his shirt a little wet. But Jun doesn't mind.
"Web design," he explains patiently. "You know, for company websites and stuff."
"The power bill's gone up with you around," Sho tells him.
Sho-chan, meanwhile, is trying to save Japan.
Sho swats at Aiba, who laughs and sidesteps it neatly.
"Okay, just the Japanese economy."
Somehow, Jun can believe that.
"Weren't you trying to get into university?"
There's a beat, and then Sho and Aiba exchange an amused, knowing glance.
"You really did listen in on our entire conversation, didn't you?" "I just... guess I overheard," Jun says, cheeks flushing again at being found out. "Nino talked loud."
He hasn't been able to explain this inexplicable curiosity, this daunting fascination. Even now, when they are friends, it is something he has gotten on the inside of, but not quite yet. It keeps him here.
"Actually, yes, I'm trying to get into university."
Sho is serious now. "I've been a little distracted the past few years, but I guess it was just because I thought I couldn't do it anyway."
"Pachinko," Aiba says. "He used to be addicted to it, until he decided, like any sensible person would, that Ono's pastry is preferable to a smoky, noisy place where you stare at a machine that cheats you out of money."
"Graphic," Jun remarks.
"Economics and pachinko, though?"
"I've got a diverse range of interests," Sho says, and Aiba snorts, though Jun catches the affection. "But it's serious business now. I'm trying for the entrance exams in February next year. Student loans can be really quite a bitch, though."
"I've told you the cafe makes enough..."
"And I've told you that I can't take your money."
Sho's reply is terse.
Jun can tell it's an old topic being rehearsed. "I'll scrape through."
"Besides, you part-time here, right?" Jun puts in.
Sho looks surprised at Jun's statement.
"I do?" "Well, sometimes you're behind the counter giving looks to people who order coffee too late. Primarily me."
"Oh, that's just..." Sho shrugs offhand, and Jun can tell he's never thought of it as a job. "Just covering for each other,"
You really ought to let me pay for my coffee then, June says, the slightest bit uncertain.
I mean, it's not like you're Starbucks and can afford to give people lifelong discounts after they help you mop up split grounds.
It's not because of that, Iba says, and there's a genuine shock, like the whole thing is something June hasn't gotten. It's because you're one of us. How can I put a price on you being here?
Oh, June says. A warmth blooms in his chest, unexpected and alluring, and he forgets student loans and misses the smile that touches the corner of Shaw's mouth.
June believes in finding love in crowded cities, in serendipity and soulmates. He believes in fleeting glances on the train and across the street, that instance of attraction that is more curiosity than anything else. And he believes that all that can turn into something more. He's sworn that he won't miss it when it comes for him. But he buys a train ticket to Kagoshima and runs away. Runs to the end of Japan, away from the exact thing he thought he was looking for.
So, how do you guys know Ono-san and Nino-san? Yun takes prim bites from a croissant. The day is nearly over for the rest of the city, but for them it can mean it is just starting. Aiba settles further into his seat and Sho finally puts away his book, massaging his temples.
Aiba grins. Ochan has a bakery, which you probably already know. It's near Tsukiji. That's because he's also a fish kind of guy. But his bakery was struggling at the same time I just opened a cafe and realized I couldn't make coffee and upkeep the place and bake all the bread while maintaining some semblance of life functions.
Sho chuckles under his breath. Ono came by trying to get clients to supply. Back then, Aiba had only gone 1 week without sleep and wasn't yet tired of eating his own unsold bread 3 times a day, so he turned him down.
Aiba laughs at the reproving look on Sho's face. Then a week later he brought Nino. At the end of it, I was thanking him for letting me put in my orders. And he was saying, it's just to see how it goes, really. And I couldn't think with anything except getting some sleep.
But it worked, June says, and they both nod.
And then Nino would come by, just to check whether you're displaying them properly. And he'd bring Ono along.
Aiba's grin is soft at the edges, frayed by nostalgia and recollection.
By then, Sho was a recovering pachinko addict and business was just beginning to pick up for all of us, so we all kind of clicked.
Though Nino stole a lot of bread, Sho notes. Which we are thankful for anyway, because he doesn't eat much else, practically.
Nino seems smart, June says.
He's a sharp little bastard, Sho says,
and the contrast between the words and the tone makes something surge in June's chest. He doesn't think he's ever met a closer group of four in the world.
Aiba reads it in June's expression, and he reaches a hand over, a casual touch on June's knee. It's comforting, but all the same, June can't bring himself to put his faith in this. It's so much bigger than him that he hasn't a hope of understanding.
He's an idiot if you had to tell him, Nino says.
Nino, Ono chides. A mild, unspoken argument passes between them, and they hold eye contact a moment long enough for Sho to take notice.
I know, Nino says, but...
He sighs and gets up to perch on the arm of the chair in which Aiba is sitting, eyes downcast.
We all need to be able to afford to be idiots once in a while,
Ono tells him soothingly, but his eyes are on Aiba, and Nino returns to his own seat, to allow Ono to pry the sadness gently off Aiba's person, even if just for one night. The train pulls into Miyazaki on a quiet Saturday morning. June picks up a brochure at the station. He meanders around the town, a gangly mix of garish and neglected, noting the various pachinko parlors dotting the city center. He tries to ignore the fact that his thoughts immediately spring back to a warm cafe in Tokyo, as each street corner reveals yet another of those loud signs. Pachinko coin and slot, they declare. He resists the urge to step into one of them, for some wretched notion of seeing what had kept Sho there for hours once upon a time. No, not even to get out of the cold.
Consulting the brochure, he decides to take a bus to the Udo Jingu Shrine, which appears to be the sole attraction. He backtracks all the way to the station and buys a ticket, catching a nearly empty bus. It is off-season to be going anywhere around here. By the time Jun gets there, battling his way along the bitter coastal winds on the ocean side of the shrine grounds, he can see perfectly why. No one wants to be here in the middle of winter. No one. Except it appears an old couple wandering slowly down the path, seemingly unfazed by the droughts threatening to erupt into full-blown hurricane. Jun is afraid that one of them will be whipped up by the wind, carried over the creaky wooden fence and off into the sea. The other would probably be dragged off too, and Jun would have to try to save them, although he can't freaking fly. At the tip of the cliff, he peeks over. A blood-curdling drop down. The waves thrash and writhe relentlessly around a large, flattish boulder that a sign informs him is called Turtle Rock. A shimenawa rope lies atop the rock face. During the festival season, worshippers gather here and buy clay pebbles to throw into the hallowed area marked out of the rope. Throws that stay inside, protected from the waves, are said to win favor with the kami. One will have life, love, and good fortune. Jun improvises, picking up the few pebbles littering the area, probably left from the last festival. The first two attempts skid off into the angry water, but suddenly he gets the hang of it, and his pebbles are making perfect landings. A little pile of them are gathered inside the shimenawa rope, and it irrationally infuriates him. It cannot be this easy. Because if it were, he wouldn't be here at all. He wouldn't be miles away from home in the middle of deep winter, braving an octogenarian haunt to shoot hoops for the gods.
"Excuse me," a voice says, half blown away by the wind, even as the words are said.
Dune starts, nearly dropping all his pebbles. For a brief second, he thinks the kami are about to demand a stern word with him for mentally mocking their rock. But obviously, that isn't it. It's just the old man and his wife, who've made it to the edge of the cliff, too.
"You're supposed to throw them with your left hand," the man tells him mildly, with an air of a, for your information, telephone hotline.
Jun, meanwhile, is still a little too shaken to do anything but nod.
"The kami like it better that way," the wife adds.
Jun switches hands. The couple ambles on. On a now deserted cliff on the southern coast of Kyushu, Jun misses every shot at the favor of the kami. Sometimes you think you're doing everything right, in pursuit of everything you're waiting for, and that it's just got to come eventually. The last of the pebbles bounce against the boulder's edge before disappearing into the rippling froth. And then you realize that it's not quite that simple. He scoops up a new handful, and each time they seem to get imperceptibly nearer, just skidding off the edge of success, until once again becoming wildly off the mark, plunging to their unfavored ends. Nondescript failures. Fool on you. Blind to everything you claim to be looking for. It is freezing, but he doesn't even feel the numb bake of his fingers as he tosses rocks off into the ocean, no longer bothering to take aim. Fool on you for leaving it behind. Aiba and Sho can scarcely remember a time when the cafe didn't have Jun around, but still, they have each other, and it is not by any stretch lonely. They persevere through their daily routines, closely tuned to the surge and ebb of people throughout the day. The coffee is made, paid for, and drunk. The bread sells, the cash machine kept busy. Nino and Ono put in their presences once in a while, to be spoiled shamelessly by Aiba. The stock is taken every day at 9, Sho temping at the counter in the meantime, book in hand.
Shaw ups the ante on studying, going back to the case studies and theories after 10, while Aiba retreats into the kitchen to wash, scrub, mop, balance the accounts and scrub again, just to keep the cafe open a little longer. The sign on the door never gets flipped over. Every once in a while, when he's not thinking about it, Shaw's eyes wander up to the faded street for a faded coat on its way home. Aiba's hand still in the dirty dishwasher whenever he thinks he hears the jingle of a door opening, the muffled sound of outside being cut off by footsteps inside. It dulls after a while, and between them there are less of the abrupt head jerks that neither of them inclined to openly acknowledge. When the clock has wandered somewhere after 1, Aiba will finally step outside to turn over the sign hanging on the door. And when the welcome is facing inside instead of "sorry, we're closed," Shaw knows the pretense is over, and that it is time to lock up and go upstairs, and stop waiting for the day. One time, June walks into the cafe at 7, resentful to discover the place entirely occupied. For a moment, he nearly walks right out, to turn left and head for Starbucks instead. But then he realizes that if Happy Bean was full up, then Starbucks probably had people sitting on the floor and hanging off the walls by their collars. He sits moodily at one of the outdoor tables, resentfully displaced by a bunch of young office workers with their jackets off and their ties loose, talking obnoxiously loudly. For lack of motivation to do anything else, he watches the crowd trickle past, the couples hand in hand and the circles of friends, self-contained bubbles oblivious to the world and its pushing. It's one of those nights where his mind wanders to first dates and first kisses. Yuki had been pretty. They'd both been terribly young, and Yun too fascinated with the way she allowed him to lift her chin for a 2-second kiss. In fact, 3 dates on, he was still enthralled, the butterflies in his gut wild and intent on making his words tumble over each other, that the little crease of dissatisfaction in the middle of her forehead, the nonverbal complaint of not enough, eventually meant that Yun cried into his pillow and pretended to his mother that it was because of the D's he's gotten on his test the next day. And then Minami, years later, who hadn't been conventionally pretty, but did try. She made him laugh, though sometimes inwardly cringe with embarrassment at how much older and smarter she was. Indeed, only a year, except it seemed like an unreachable forever, because she left after her graduation, and Yun only wrote 1 letter. How fast they all forgot. He runs his mind through the years, the coy months which turned draggy, the sporadic one-offs, the flirtatious could-have-beens, the growing pains, schoolboy crushes, now underwhelming, and the self-confident maturity, with the conviction it lent to the "I love yous" and "there's nothing I wouldn't do for yous." They pushed past him, once so vivid and real, and now just startling in their sameness, their being passed. All those years, the irregularity of confused emotion, the shaky starts and the sudden stops, how they all gradually settled into the same calm, the same equilibrium of being alone. Undeniably, there's something he loves in solitude, but sometimes it congeals into this desperation, his clawing loneliness that stutters inside of him on days like these. Aiba comes outside to retrieve him somewhere past 9. He wanders in, still morose. Aiba does the requisite fussing over, albeit a little more than usual. June assumes he feels bad for him sitting outside. Still, on nights like this, June is short with people and Aiba is no exception. He declines coffee, even when Aiba offers him cake. "Ochan specially baked it," he insists. "And it's really good because Ochan's cakes always are, and they sell so fast, and it was for..." "Stop pushing," June snaps. Aiba recoils. "I said I don't want any." "Okay, then," Aiba mumbles. "I'll bring it inside." June ignores the sour aftertaste of snapping at Aiba. He barely succeeds.
"He kept it for you, you know," Shaw says, coming up beside him, laptop left open a few seats away. "They sell so fast, as in, when someone asked for the last piece, he smiled, apologized, said no, and put it in the fridge inside." The nagging feeling becomes a full-fledged guilt, and Jun sighs.
Okay, I got it.
Shaw looks at him closely.
You okay? What's wrong?
Jun toys with the idea of blurting out everything on his mind, but even he cannot credibly describe this palpable yet formless ache that haunts him on nights like these. He's used to them, except not in this setting. Normally he's home, watching television, or staring at the computer screen, or his bedroom ceiling.
But this time I'm not.
Because familiarity breeds nonchalance. You fail to see what you have every day simply because you have it every day. It's a blessing and a curse, when you wait forever on one platform for a train that pulls in on the other side. But a quick switch in vision is all it takes. He's no longer alone.
Nothing's wrong, Jun tells Shaw. I'll go talk to him.
Shaw moves back to examining his laptop screen, crammed with words, nodding when Jun mutters a low, rushed thanks. Aiba is busying himself with tidying the counter. He doesn't look up.
Hey.
No response.
Could I get a coffee, please?
Yeah, Aiba says, attention already on the coffee maker. I'll bring it to you.
Don't suppose you've got any cake, though,
Jun says to Aiba's back, which stills.
I heard there's some fabulous cake here, but I must be too late.
Sorry, Aiba says. Then he turns to face Jun, and his eyes are laughing. And Jun knows everything is okay. It's for Shaw-chan now.
We could share, Jun prods.
Aiba pretends to contemplate.
I guess there's enough for the both of you.
He stoops to take the plate he'd taken out earlier.
Thanks,
Jun says. Aiba's grin is stunning when he swats Jun's hand away from the coffee cup, insisting, I'll bring it out, go sit by Shaw. He lets it slip away into the quiet laughter and comfort of midnight companionship, but it sits in his chest and chases the void away. He's never been so easily redeemed before.
Jun inches up the Shinkansen line traversing Kyushu, passing quickly over into Honshu, through Fukuoka. It is still winter, and darkness falls by four each evening. It takes him a week to realize how steep train fares are, and he starts staying at inns which have Wi-Fi, tapping on his laptop all night to keep up with his client's request and trying not to think of where else he could be. He tells himself he is traveling and not running, and not looking for something. But at each stop he steps into a cafe, and with each sip two faces bob into his memory, and he knows he has not left any of it behind. It has followed him for miles. At Hiroshima, he takes a break to visit the A-bomb museum, wandering through the exhibits, the somber facts of decades ago. He continues his northern path, stopping only briefly in Okayama before leaving for Osaka. In a bookshop, he sees a thick, wordy volume which he is sure Shaw would like. He even asks the shopkeeper for its price, but backs out of the transaction at the last moment. He is not too far from Tokyo, and though he could go right to the very end, to Hokkaido, he knows he won't. But he isn't ready to be so definite yet. He sees a path home to not one, but two, on train maps and in his mind. But the road there is long, and only his to bear. On Shaw's birthday, they all get together in the cafe and have a party. At least Aiba insists it's a party. Although Nino maintains that it is not, because there are no girls and no strippers and no drunken orgies. At which point Ono whispers something into his ear, which means Aiba gets his way after all. And even Nino starts calling it a party.
Happy birthday to you,
they sing, voices meshing not too flatteringly. Shaw can make out his and Aiba's, and Nino's and Ono's. Afterwards, Aiba forgets whose birthday it is and accidentally blows out a candle, while Nino teases Shaw about his age.
Doesn't make a difference, look at how many you've still got.
They toss Nino and Ono out at 12:15 so they'll make the last train home. Shaw clears up the empty plates and forks. When he's done with the washing, he walks out and sees Aiba standing mutely,
cake remnants and a box still on the table. He follows Iba's gaze to the empty chair, the high stool at the end of the bar table, the most convenient one for a PowerPoint and an offer of coffee past 11.
"Let's go to my place tonight," Shaw says, and Iba nods wordlessly.
They break into a run at the station, seeing the words "Last train to Wakoshi" flash across the board next to the bright orange 12:55. Iba gets pulled along by Shaw. Shaw's always been better at navigating train platforms, and they're both out of breath and laughing by the time they dash through the train doors just in time. They stand by the window, watching the streets rush by in a blur of light and dark, alive and asleep. Two stops later, the female voice announces,
"Senkawa,"
and they get off onto the platform. It is chilly. Iba pulls his coat tight around him as they walk the five streets to Shaw's flat. Shaw's apartment is tiny. Shaw locks the door behind him, their limbs nudging around each other for space. Iba heads for bed immediately. Shaw makes a quick bathroom stop, and by the time he's out, Iba's chest is rising and falling with a slow regularity that cannot be faked. The bed creaks a little as he crawls in beside Iba's warmth, trying not to shake it too much, but Iba moves anyway, closing the distance between them. "Happy birthday," he says, cold nose against Shaw's cheek. Through Iba's hair, Shaw can make out the neon-lit digital clock. It is no longer his birthday.
"I love you," he says instead,
throwing a leg over Iba's, and nothing has changed in the smile he gets in return. The four words whispered back because only he needs to hear it. He hesitates before saying it, but does anyway. "Iba, if he comes back." A tiny degree of tension surfaces on the if. Shaw feels it, skin to skin, heart to heart, mind to mind.
"He has to."
Shaw cannot feel his own heartbeat, but he feels Iba's. A steady doki-doki that sometimes makes the emotions at such close range nearly swallow him whole.
"If he wants to come back, he has to love you too."
The words are quietly spoken, but there is a fierce undertone that they both understand. It is 3 a.m. and they are awake. The warmth becomes heat, and they shuck their jeans slowly, pushing them down with each other's feet in unhurried motions. Shaw rolls on top of Iba, it is his birthday after all, and moves smoothly, undulating. They gasp between kisses and forget everything else, because this is everything, until all of a sudden it is urgent and inevitable and enough.
"You ever think about dreams?" June says.
"Dreams?"
The thought crease on Iba's forehead appears. June leans back in a chair he's taken into the kitchen just to watch Iba work.
"When I was a kid, I wanted to train tigers, make friends with them."
June laughs.
"I bet you could, too. But high school didn't offer that as a subject, so I started wanting to be a basketball star."
"You were good at basketball?"
"Good at watching,"
Iba says, putting a freshly washed plate onto the counter. June moves to help him, picking up the dish towel.
I was more of a baseball kind of kid," June says.
"So what made you open a cafe instead?"
"Idiocy," Iva says. "And after that, I had all these loans to the fridge people and the coffee people, and I had to make it work somehow."
"But is it what you've always wanted, besides the basketball thing?"
"No." Iva looks June seriously in the eye. "But how many people get that? I don't watch basketball tournaments anymore. And Shaw bought himself a bunch of university books instead of trying to get his mail past the government's security filters. If I had my dreams, then I wouldn't have this. And that's nowhere near a fair deal."
"I suppose in a way," June says, though he is unconvinced.
"The trouble with dreams isn't that they are grand or impractical or out of reach. The trouble is when something good comes along and you can't see it. You're too busy looking out. The ship comes into harbor and you're staring at the horizon. It's dangerous, Junkun. You could miss everything that way."
He pulls into Tokyo just as February is in slow melt.
Tsukiji, he remembers, and changes over to the subway line.
He needs to be sure, and even though it is Ono's bread and Nino's marketing, it is always from Aiba, always with Sho, and he needs just one familiar step on solid ground to know. It is not running away. It is the final step. Affirmation. Ono's bakery is dingy from the outside, but once Jun steps in, the smell of warm bread baking is absolutely divine, a world of its own. He looks at the selection on display, but fails to make a choice. Instead, he walks up to the counter which Ono is sitting behind, seemingly absorbed in an advert about fishing rods.
"I'll have whatever you're baking now," he says. He doesn't expect Ono to recognize him, but Ono does.
"It's you," says Ono, and his tone is one of unexpected mild surprise.
Jun expects some sort of fist-shaking, collar-grabbing, you lousy escapist bastard. But Ono just gets up to go into the kitchen, and in retrospect, yeah, Ono's not really the type to do that. But maybe Nino is, judging by the way the door swings open and he stops in his tracks, saying, "You!" in an entirely different tone of voice. Ono reappears.
"You've got to wait a few minutes for it to be done," he says.
"Oh, hey, Nino."
"That's fine," says Jun, distracted by Nino's air of confrontational leopard, hackles raised.
"What? He's too chicken to bite from Aiba himself," Nino snorts. "Pathetic."
"Nino," Ono says, a note of warning that quiets the man down. Although he's still bristling with hostility, Jun can feel it emanating off him.
"You both have the right to be angry," Jun says, "but I'm here because I need to make sure. I'll take a train there after this, but I have to sort out some things, and this is the last of them."
Unexpectedly, Nino softens, no longer poised for attack.
"Fine," he says, and marches into the kitchen. "I hope I didn't forget the previous batch. The butter won't melt on them if you've forgotten."
"I haven't," Ono answers. "And Ryo wants to know something about the flour for next week. Call him, will you?"
Is Nino's grunt of assent.
"Sit down,"
Ono says, pointing to another wooden stool just behind the counter.
"Thank you."
Ono resumes his seat and waits. Jun sighs.
"How's the cafe?" he asks.
Ono peers at something in the advert, making a tiny "hmm" sound.
"Still open, still late," he says. "Sales are up. The end of winter caused a rise in coffee drinking."
"That's so?" Jun says. "Are they terribly busy?"
"Not much different,"
Ono says.
He hardly dares to ask,
"And will anything change if I go back?"
Inside, Nino's arguing about the price of whole grain.
"Things changed when you came, not when you left."
"So I still can, if I want."
"If you want,"
Ono says with an intensity in the word that makes Jun a bit uncomfortable.
"What is it you want, though? What is it you want out of going back?"
"I want to know if there's room for me," Jun admits.
"I don't quite think that's for me to answer,"
Ono says. And for one miserable second, Jun's heart sinks. Except Ono isn't quite finished.
"But I'll tell you something else."
"Okay," Jun says. He'll take whatever he can get.
Ono continues, calmly.
"A year ago, I saw Nino cry for the first time in all my years of knowing him. And that wasn't even the worst. Business was picking up. We were comfortable, shared a flat. But a girl ended a relationship of 2 years and he cried his heart out. And then he wanted to leave."
Ono exhales, and Jun detects just a hint of weariness.
packed his bags even. Told me he'd put the keys on the table for the next time I lost mine.
Did he?
I stood at the door for an hour, and then I let him leave.
Why?
Because he was afraid. Because the thing with the girl shook him, and he wasn't sure anymore. Not even of something we'd be doing for years and years.
We three haven't had nearly that much time.
June can't help but say.
It's not time that defines it, Orno tells impatiently.
He came back, and he wasn't so afraid anymore. But he still thinks of her sometimes. Looks at other girls. Our uncertainties never leave us. We got to live them out.
What if I daren't?
June says, very quietly, for the first time he admits to his unholy, insidious fear.
Of course you dare. There's always room for fear. Everything starts out as the unknown. It's the maps and plans and instructions you've got for yourself that are so terrifying.
You think they aren't afraid just because they were together first?
No,
Andy says, just as it dawns on him.
They don't know either,
Ono says, and this time he's smiling. And June realizes this has been true all along. They are waiting to find out. We all are.
About the bread,
he says, and Ono's expression already knows what he's going to say. But he says it anyway.
Maybe next time.
And thank you. It is rare that they are all here in the morning, but Joe has a class to get to that will run late, and June pops in for a morning coffee before an important business meeting with a new client. He wears a suit instead of a t-shirt, suddenly looking like part of the office crowd, except they traipse in and out with barely a second to spare. The women click smartly in their heels, and the men tap their feet impatiently. Even while the coffee is brewing, their eyes and thumbs never leave their iPhones. June and Joe sit together, laptops in their cases and not on the tabletop for once. Instead, they watch Aiba hurry around, stepping in at odd moments so the show runs seamlessly and they don't hold up the morning traffic so typical of the city. June tries to help, but Joe refuses to let him handle coffee because he's wearing a suit. And surely you can't have forgotten what happens with Aiba and coffee around. By 10, the crowd has thinned and Joe has out a book. Nowadays he never goes without them for long. June distractedly skims over the page Joe is studying, mentally running through the things he wants to say later at the meeting. Aiba appears, sweat on his brow.
Good news, he announces. Ono's baked donuts today. He's bringing them over later. I'll keep some for you too. You coming over tonight?
You know that question is redundant when Ono bakes donuts, Joe tells him.
Aiba grins. Of course he knows.
What's your birthday, Junkun? Aiba asks. Yours in January. We need something to celebrate in the meantime.
You just like getting Ono to bake.
Nope. When it's Junkun's birthday, I'll bake the cake myself.
Are you sure? That might land him in ER.
Yo-chan, Aiba says very seriously. You can't say things like that. People will hear. And my cafe is not going to live on your business alone.
Fine, fine, says Hyo, throwing his hands up and laughing. I'll just go back to my book.
Aiba is dismayed to find out that it is in August. But we just missed it, he says.
Don't worry, it'll be along again presently, Hyo tells him.
Okay, Aiba says, somewhat consoled. August next year, I'll bake you the best birthday cake you ever had. Maybe with a little bit of Ono's help. He admits at Sho's raised eyebrow. And no one will go to ER, he adds with emphasis. It is a strange feeling for someone to place themselves in your future, something usually restricted to your private thoughts, prayers, and predictions. The last time June had been promised next year, he had exchanged the same guarantee and had taken all of a month to renege and regret. But this promise is different. Not lost in the hullabaloo of romance, unnecessarily weighted down by expectation. He can't quite tell if he believes. You see, I'm worried about things like the future. But one look at Aiba's face and he forgets why. For once, it is truly, really very hard to leave for work.
He stops one last time, one last transit before he allows himself to reach his destination. Starbucks this time, the precursor to where it began. This time, to let in a whole new beginning. June sees the green letters illuminated from two streets away. It is just past 9, and tonight he will finally be on time. The place is filled with a buzz of concurrent conversations, punctuated by the occasional yell of "One mocha frappe, no whipped cream." The girls sit poised, hair carefully blown and in place, sipping their matcha lattes and swapping off his gossip. The large groups break into sporadic outbursts of hysteria while some sit alone, a book or iPad in their laps. He doesn't even have to order to be sure. Doesn't have to take that first steaming sip that falls conspicuously short of intoxicating. He's just passing through. He sidesteps a couple coming inside and slips out through the swinging glass doors. There's somewhere else he needs to be, and finally, it's the last lap, pulling back into harbour. Shaw sees June first. He doesn't believe it, though, the way you can think about something so much it loses the capacity to become real. It is not until it's obvious that it is June, and June is halfway through the doors, that Shaw reacts. He springs to his feet, grabbing June by the arm. The jingle at this hour is what both of them have been listening for, and Aiba will be out in a second if he doesn't say something to avert it.
"I'm just going outside for a bit, to get some fresh air," Shaw calls out,
and it is such a feeble excuse that he barely waits for Aiba's faint "okay," before hauling June back out the door. Shaw's expression is tight, pinched, and for a moment the possibility of rejection nearly makes June run.
"He wants to see you, obviously," Shaw says. "And maybe I don't have a right to stop you from doing so, but if you're just here to apologize and leave, then you should skip the first part. Don't bother."
He notices the resolution in June's eyes. Not experience, but something that wasn't there before. It nearly makes him yield. He wants June to touch him again, wrap his coat around the both of them, warm the night up. But no, not after the first time.
"I'm not here to leave,"
June says, and Shaw's gut swoops.
"Then what?"
It is a demand spoken, much more desperate in his head.
"I want to come back." "I don't care what you've put me through," Shaw thinks, "but I could kill you for what you've put him through."
I'm sure."
"Sure?"
Shaw says, and June visibly winces at the disbelief.
"Or have you just convinced yourself that we're that indefinable something you've been looking for, that the reality suddenly has the decency to turn up something perfect, and that we'll turn out to be something you've imagined for yourself? That we're enough?"
He hadn't realized he'd been so angry, and it suddenly bubbles up, unstoppable.
"We will not be your brand of enough."
June takes a deep breath.
"I won't miss it this time."
"No, I don't want you to be." And for one heart-stopping moment, Shaw's brain takes the words out of context. It is ridiculous the way his throat constricts at that one statement.
"I'll take whatever you're willing to give," June says. "But I haven't done this in a while. Not ever, really. And I'm sort of terrified, but..."
Shaw gives in. He closes the gap, wraps arms fully around someone he's missed for 2 months, breathes out. It doesn't last long. Shaw doesn't allow it. He isn't the only one who's been waiting. He untangles them and pushes the door back open. Except this time, he stands aside. It is unspoken. This has to be between June and Aiba.
"Aiba?"
June says. Something drops, clatters against the floor, and then Aiba is there, wordlessly, one step after another out of the kitchen. And she understands why he can hardly believe, because he couldn't either.
Iba, Jun repeats, and the need for Iba to say his name claws at his throat. I'm sorry I left. Iba doesn't say anything. They're face to face now, and from the sidelines, Shaw watches Iba's face carefully, every inch of his stance protective. But I won't again. It's almost a lie. He wants to flee now, except this time from Iba's silence. This mortifying lack of response. This alien absence of reassurance. And maybe this is a chance I lost the first time, and I ought to be sorry enough not to come back, but... Iba is taller than him, he realizes, before he even has time to process why he knows this. That's not true, Iba says, muffled into Jun's hair, and Jun almost cries with relief. He hadn't thought that he'd be absolved twice. It is too much to ask. And now, too much to question. Upstairs, they peel the clothes off Jun's travel-weary body as he settles between them. It is a tiny bed, but they need no space between them tonight. How much have I missed? Jun asks, speech muffled by sleep and shared bedclothes. Hyo-chan got into university, Iba says. Jun has to take a moment to marvel again at the fact that they are all touching, that there was room after all. You're incredible, he tells Shaw, and something else pops into his mind. And I missed something else. Happy birthday. And even though it isn't his birthday anymore, Shaw laughs and kisses the nape of Jun's neck. Iba leans in too, and for the first time, Jun discovers that Iba does taste of his coffee, and maybe he allows himself the indulgence of the notion. That is why he loved it so much. Right from the start. Go to sleep, he tells Iba, whose eyelids are already sliding shut. It is not long before Shaw's breathing evens out too. But Jun lies there, reveling in the simultaneous newness and familiarity. He hardly dares to let himself slip into sleep, because he is afraid when he wakes up, when he blinks, it will be gone. But Shaw's hand snakes across his waist, fingers meeting and resting on Iba's arm, even though they are both asleep. The fear drains away. It is impossible that this will leave. They are already so close. He cannot tell them apart.
Cheese.